So what we face is a collective shock. And for me, the beauty that lies in this horror is the potential for the birth of this new spirituality, or the recovery of this new spirituality, in inner terms rather than in external terms. The word potential is fascinating because it is a Latin word that comes from the original Greek. And the original Greek word for potential was dynamis, which is interesting because we recognize that word. It has been abstracted to, in our society, to simply mean, well, something that might be. But in its original Greek sense, potential was not just some abstraction of something that could be, but rather a very real existence of what we psychologically call the unconscious. So the challenge that we face is to go into this superconscious mind that Hahnemann teaches us about, which is what you do when you do a proving. He calls it Erkenntnis, this kind of pure reason or superconsciousness. And which is, if anyone studied philosophy, is found in Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. This word was never used before the Romantic Age. And the American Revolution was born out of the Romantic Age. And it means, in essence, that we have to take that superconscious mind that we have been given, and we have to delve into our unconscious, into our darkness. We have no choice. So the evil that, in a sense, we face is really a failure of our ability to go into our unconscious and transform what is dark into light. And it will simply fester there and will be reflected back to us. But we find that in our patients. If they do not confront their darkness, then they're condemned to live that darkness. And you see it every day. But it's not a prison. At the same time that we have this world of polarity, we are also given the power of medicine. And this again is the, I think, something that you have that very few other people have, is this knowledge of a way to achieve this new world, this true new world. That we don't have to be in despair, that we're just going to be in the same cycle. Either we do nothing and terrorism triumphs, or we retaliate and we get more terror and more violence. There is another path, but it's a narrow one. It's the narrow gate that the Bible mentions. Not the broad gate that generally most people march down. It's a difficult one. And it has to be done individually. But I think if you realize that the world you're going to live in is a function of your state of mind, then even if one person makes a change, then you've already shifted the collective state of mind. So, of course, most of us think, well, what can I do? What can one person do against this massive unfolding that will take place, this kind of clash of the titans that will now occur at the political level? But there's a tremendous amount you can do, because ultimately what's happening in the external world is very subject to your thought process. And if you can change your thought process, then you will live in a very different world, and it will start to shift. But now the creation of the world depends very much on us. And to me, I think this is the deeper unconscious shock of what happened on Tuesday. It's a kind of recognition that we have been going about it the wrong way. And there's a certain despair that comes with that. And a certain searching for how do we go about it the right way. Certainly that's what I hear from the people that I've talked to, who in their heart fear the terror that will come from more terror, but the hopelessness of, well, we have to do something. And they feel caught in that place. Go. Anyway, I've talked far too long. Sorry. No. Francis. It is scary, no question. And so you need remedies sometimes to help you through that. Depends on your state of balance and your state of health. And none of us is so healthy that probably we don't need opium. But at least we have opium.
Rudy, you have a really remarkable gift for pulling knowledge from all different fields and synthesizing and integrating it. It's just fascinating. What I'm still struggling with is the notion that this is somehow a terribly new act. I mean, it's been said here from a few people and certainly in the online study group, this is not new. This has happened to people all over the world and, you know, throughout history. And even the notion of Americans being a particular people who, you know, who like light, for example, that strikes me as a bit, I don't know. Light is a powerful image in all. I think almost every religious teaching, certainly Christ our light, every Easter vigil, Christ is the light. Every Hindu knows, the entire Hindu world is lit up, you know, with candlelight once a year at least. So how is this notion that this is truly a new and different moment for all of humanity? And do these kind of meetings not take place in other parts of the world where they have experienced something similar? And I mean, there are thinking people all over the world, and I'm sure they get together in their prayer groups or their university groups, and they say, come on, we can't let these, you know, bonehead leaders of ours lead us down the path of destruction. So how is this profoundly new?
Oh, how's this? Okay. This intimidates me. But, you know, and it goes back to something that Rudy said 5 or 10 minutes ago, I think, and that has to do with the notion of trust. And I think that, and I may have misunderstood Rudy, but I think the American people generally did trust. Their motto is, in God we trust. I think that on another level, American people trusted their government and certainly their military to protect them. I think that North Americans of my generation and younger people have never experienced war at any level. And I think that we expected our governments to be able to protect us from this kind of thing. This is something that is totally foreign to North America. And it has, it's not that the act itself is any more grievous than those acts that have happened in other parts of the world. It's just incredibly shocking that it has happened here to us. And I think that's why we are really struggling in North America.
I think what you said about in God we trust is very true for the American people at the time that that was indoctrinated into their culture. I don't know that that's a truth presently. When these people go to their phallic symbol of an office tower every morning and they sit down and they turn on their computer and they start organizing people's financial portfolios, I don't know that it's in God they trust that comes to mind. I believe that what occurred is an abomination of human life. But what I keep seeing reappear as a fundamental truth when this kind of annihilation occurs is that that culture or group may have missed the boat in the God we trust. And I think that what comes out of that is sometimes a balancing of the evil and the good. Sometimes it's a call to wake up, I believe. There's a piece about In God We Trust that I think that I want to address, and it's not enough. It has to be a true trust. It can't be a false trust, in the sense that you can't just give it all up and not do your part. So it's the falsity is not that it's not okay to trust God. The falsity is you can't go to church every Sunday and pray or do whatever religion people adhere to and think that just by doing that once a week that's enough. That's a false trust, because you have to every day, every moment, as much as you can, be living the love and the trust. And I think that's a little bit where things have gotten off the path, and it relates a little bit to something Rudy said, but I can't quite tie it in, about the independence. And that's the stage we're at now, and I think that's a little bit the trigger. People are realizing that you can't be living a lie some of the time and be trusting God the rest of the time. It has to be true, and it has to be based in love all of the time. Otherwise, it's not a true trust.
I just, Irene, go ahead. No, I was just going to answer Nira's question, but you go ahead. You go ahead. Well,
I just wanted to bring up something that Rudy can talk about better than me, but when we had the Steiner classes and all that, we talked about consciousness and how the Western world and probably this type of society is to be considered the highest level of consciousness that we as humanity have attained. So I'm thinking, if that's the highest level, and if we subscribe to the belief that things happen to us for a purpose so that we can learn and evolve, so we can look at this thing that happened in the States as something that has to be taught the hard way. It's like with disease. When you get disease, it's because you're not getting something, so it has to hurt you, cause pain, in order to finally wake you up and you start looking for solutions. So I'm thinking, it's not that so many people died in an hour. We all say they die everywhere. But the fact is that it had to happen at a place where we all thought it was impossible for such a thing to happen. Everywhere else it happens, and we sort of say, well, there's always been war there, or this is a region that's at war. You know, and I think that here in North America that there's never been war, there's some sort of acceptance that war can exist somewhere, and that we are the good guys because we go in there with our might and military and economics and we fix the problem. And I think what happened is going to start people thinking about what is it that we have been doing to the world that has caused so much pain and we didn't know about it. It has to hurt us in order for us to... And I was going to ask Rudy, because I can't put it into words, but this thing about the level of consciousness and having to move now into from the material world into the next step in our evolution to our ego, right? I feel that this somehow is a symbol or something that's going to push a lot of people into realizing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd just like to comment first on something Nira said, because I think it's very important to address, and I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. The problem when we talk about these things in a scientific way, because that's what I hope we're talking about them as, and I don't mean cold Western material science, but in the true sense of truth-seeking, which is what the word science originally meant, is that we have to separate out prejudgments and prejudices. So when we're talking about America, we're not talking about the America that you can go down and visit if you drive across the border. We're talking about a state of mind. That it happens to manifest itself in this geography or this particular place on Earth consciousness, that's simply a historical fact. But the American state of mind can be found anywhere. can be found in India, can be found in China, can be found in Cuba, can be found in France, you know, wherever. Wherever there are people who share that state of mind, you will find it there. Just as you will find the older forms of consciousness, which are represented by China or India or the Middle East, you will find those here, physically, in North America. So we're not talking about that. And we're not talking about superiority of one culture over another culture. And we're not talking about one is better than the other because it's a state, higher state of consciousness. This is not a value judgment. There is no value here. It is simply a fact of evolution that will shift somewhere else. But the point is, this state of mind emerged through history in a certain way, just as you could say the state of mind that's represented by the Jewish nation prior to the coming of Christ is, why did it happen in that group of people? You know, why not over here or why not over there? Well, that's a historical fact. Very difficult to get in behind that. But that changes with the idea that anyone can enter that state of mind. It's not reserved to particular people to enter that state of mind. So the idea of America, that's what I meant when I said we all became Americans in a sense, in a kind of flash of consciousness, that there is something that the United States represents, even if it's manifested to us physically. People didn't used to get symptoms. Okay, why not? Because they heard what was going on inside. They didn't need symptoms to tell them that they were out of whack, out of balance, that there was something wrong. Animals in the wild don't generally get sick. Because if there's something wrong inside, they go and do something about it, instinctively. And early man was like that. We need symptoms now because we live, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, we live in a sensory world, and that's the only thing that registers on our radar screen. So until we get the rash and go running in to complain about it, we really don't know we have a problem. A few of us might be enlightened enough to recognize we do have a problem, but I have to say I wasn't one of those. I had to be hit in the, you know, the face with a lot of physical symptoms before I recognized that there was something out of balance in my life. So we have to have a physical symbol here. The World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the White House, whatever, in order for that to register in our consciousness. But make no mistake that the real happening is not an external one. Other towers, you know, will crash and or have crashed and everything else, but there is something that really shocks the state of mind. Look at your patients when you take cases or if you've been treated. It's not the quantity of the shock that's important. You know, you can look at some of these shocks and you think, my goodness, what are these people complaining about? You know, if you look at it purely superficially. Others, it's obvious, yes, there's a tremendous amount of suffering. But other people seem to have been so destabilized just by a couple of minor events. So it's not the quantity of the shock that's important, it's the perception. It's the penetration of a particular state of illusion that gets shattered that then causes almost an earthquake to occur. So this event, yes, on the outside you could say it's terrible, but how terrible? What are we going to measure it against? But it's terrible because it really did affect and is involved in this evolution of consciousness. And so that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the United States. Of course, it exists everywhere else. But it is geographically, you could say, concentrated in something called America. Why did they give it the name America? So you can all enter into that state of mind. And in a sense, that's what you have to do. Because what the American state of mind represents is the ultimate separation from God and nature. You see this in their society. And yes, they are religious at one level, and you know, in God we trust and everything else, and individually can be very spiritual. But the overall culture of America is, in terms of the science, which dominates, the technological dominance of America, reflects this ultimate and, you could say, further separation from God, from nature. But again, if you study Steiner and others in the esoteric writings, you see that there's a deeper reason for that. Because we had to separate in order to become independent. It's a painful separation, but in a sense, just as you have to allow your children to separate in order that they can become independent, for some people it's very painful. They can't let go. But God, in a sense, the I am that I am, can let go, and we can stand on our own. But the challenge we face now is that, unfortunately, we've gotten ourselves largely into a blind alley. Is that we have gone from a kind of paradise, which is an intimate participation in God, in ourselves, where we don't see any separation, but we have no freedom, to a state where we're so separate from God that we're totally free, or we have the maximum degree of freedom. But we also face a world where there's no meaning, because we can't see God. We live in a world where we have social Darwinism, we have mind is just a function of matter, that you are just the chance happenings of random whirling particles. And all of this material concept, is vested in the Western world because it is the maximum separation. The opposite, which is a more mystical view, which is this union and oneness with God, which reflects the old state of consciousness, you by and large find in the Eastern world. Now, what's East and West? It's relative, huh? But it is a state of mind. The Western world and the Eastern world is a state of mind. The challenge we face is to find a path that will retain our independence. So not going back to the womb, not going back to the old consciousness, but will retain our independence, but allow us to participate the world again. And this takes us back to the genius of Samuel Hahnemann. Because in a very concrete way, not abstractly and not mystically, but in a very concrete way, once you understand his system, which is not homeopathy, but Heilkens, because homeopathy doesn't participate. Homeopathy is, in a sense, a non-participative part of his system. But the deeper part of his system, which is about participation, and strangely enough, participating states of mind, this takes us back to the Logos. In the beginning was the Word. So we have to participate states of mind, which is really a reflection of language now, because that's what human beings are, language. That's what separates us from everything else in creation, is the Logos. And we have to be able to participate God and nature in such a way that we can create it in our image. So the keys of the kingdom, you could say, luckily, are consciously only truly given to those people who are healthy enough to create it in a healthy image. But for the others, you can blunder around and occasionally get the right key in the lock, and you can unleash an atom bomb, or you can unleash hatred, or a religious war, or something else. And so we have to suffer the consequences of that. But our challenge is to gain the keys to that kingdom, participate, re-engage participation, but in the sense with our consciousness, our superconsciousness, which comes only from health. And then the world that will emerge will be a reflection of that state of health. Now, whether that takes a couple thousand years or not, I don't know. But that is the challenge you face, in a sense. And that is the whole reason for this evolution of consciousness. But unfortunately, the path to getting there is very narrow. And it's very easy to fall off on the way. So it's something that requires a tremendous degree of struggle, but also a tremendous degree of responsibility. Anyway, sir, I see you have a comment.
What you just, a few minutes ago, you mentioned that one of the forms of our independence is getting away from nature. And that is a representation of the American state of mind. And this is where our technology is taking us farther and farther away from nature. I'm not that well read or in philosophy and other parts. But I don't know if that is really a good thing in itself. Our parents and grandparents, they lived so much close to nature. With our technology and being away from the nature, are we better off? That is the question that comes to my mind. And the American state of mind, or the Western state of mind, vis-a-vis the Eastern state of mind, is there a way to choose what is to be chosen, what is better, what is worse? And when America, or for that matter, President Bush says it's a war of good against evil, what claim has he that too he is the good and the rest of the world is evil? Mm-hmm. Also, I would like to bring back what you said in the very beginning, that the allopathic medicine typically believes in giving stronger and stronger medicine, getting more stronger antibiotic, till we have run out of antibiotics. Now, we are not looking into the real cause or what is causing this problem or the disease. Just trying to give in stronger and stronger medicine. And therefore, I really agree with you that we have to really look into what is the cause of the disease and treat it from there rather than fighting violence with more violence. That's not going to take us anywhere. But I would still like to hear your thoughts on the fact whether getting away from the nature, as the American state of mind is going to take us, I don't know where it's going to take us.
Well, okay, no, it's a very valid comment and observation. Just as in the answer to Neera's question, I want to be very clear here that I'm not talking in terms of values. I'm talking in terms of simply, as a scientist, observing what is happening. To say that there is an evolution of consciousness does not put a value of good or bad. It is simply a matter of fact. And it actually has no good or bad, because it could be either. So I'm not positing the Western model as good and the Eastern model as bad. All I simply said was that the Western model represents the recent evolution of consciousness. And the Eastern model, truly in historical fact, represents an older consciousness. But older does not equate with bad. Not in my world, as I'm getting older. But it's very important for us when we discuss this, and this is a challenge we all face, and I know we'll increasingly face it, and we'll face it in the classroom, and it is a good challenge because I'm glad we see so many different backgrounds and nationalities and cultures that will come here, because it is something we all have to face, is that it is not about religion, it is not about culture, it's not about values, it's about truth. And the truth isn't found in any one religion, in any one culture. The truth is found in states of mind. But those states of mind can be represented temporarily in history, as they have to be on the world scene in a sensory way, in a particular state of mind or culture. But that doesn't allow that culture to appropriate the term good, or another culture to be labeled with the term bad. So there's no value judgment here. To answer the other question, the second part of your question, in terms of is it good that technology takes us away from nature, again, I don't look upon it in terms of good or bad. I look upon it in terms of what is the meaning behind it. Because for me, when I study the world and the unfolding of the world, there has to be meaning behind what is going on. Otherwise, what's the point? I know there is meaning in life, and therefore there has to be meaning in everything. So the question is, what is the meaning behind man's separation or distancing from nature? Well, we could ask the same question. What is the meaning of the child's separation from the parents? Why? Why not stay with the parent? They'll be looked after. They'll be safe. The parent knows better. You know, what do you say to your children? You know, You're gonna go wrong there. You know, you should listen to me because I'm wiser. I have more experience. Well, the child wants to do it on his or her own. So why don't we just keep our children all at home? Because I know better than my daughter does. She's gonna run into problems, but I can't do that. So the meaning behind the separation has to be, if we look at it clearly, has to be, because that's what I see happening in essence, is an increasing freedom of the individual from nature. Now, it comes at a cost at one level, no question. But this doesn't mean it's good or bad. I can't look at our society. I may have criticisms at the human level about this is dehumanizing. You know, all these machines and people living in cities and 50-story, you know, tall buildings where 50,000 people work and, a 400 square meters. What kind of a world is that? We should all be out in nature and living in the forest and have a rippling, you know, rolling brook beside our house. But that's not the way that humanity has evolved. And so if we look deeper, rather than simply longingly, at what is the meaning behind it, the meaning I find is simply that we had to separate because prior to our separation, we had no independence. If you look at people today who are labeled schizophrenic, okay, how free are they? They're not very free. They live in a prison in a sense of their own making. Well, the schizophrenic mind that you see today as an aberration is the state of mind that man had 5,000 years ago or more. That was not an aberration. If we took you and put you back 5,000 years ago, you would be an aberration. Because the world you live in is not the world that these people live in. There has been a shift in consciousness. But that shift in consciousness has been a freedom from voices. The schizophrenic, these voices are coming from inside, but the schizophrenic hears them from outside. As if they were being told by God or the gods, the spirits, what to do. But that was the state of mind we lived in. It's a kind of servitude. You have no independence. So the state of mind we have now is one of independence. Not total independence, but greater independence. But the price we paid for that is our distancing from nature. At the same time, just prior to reaching the ultimate separation from nature, you could say, which occurred roughly around the almost in the second half of the 19th century. This was the, you could say, the high water mark of materialism. It was shattered to a large degree, but still has not suffered a fatal wound by quantum physics. And quantum physics basically threw us back into the world and said, you are not separate from your world. The very act of observing that world changes it. Now, this is a reality, a fact in physics, which is not yet recognized in any other realm of science. You don't find it in geology. You don't find it in history. You don't find it in medicine. You don't find it in biology or anthropology. You don't find it in any of those sciences. It only exists in physics. So it's kind of been isolated in this, which is recognized as being the kind of highest element of science. But this shattered this materialist view that the world out there existed independent of you and I. So now, we were given, prior to this shattering, we were given, through the evolution of humanity, we were given a seed of hope, you could say. And that seed of hope is, in essence, what you study when you study high alchemist. It's what Stephen Decker calls the dynamic system. And that dynamic system was born out of the Romantic movement. And the Romantic movement was an attempt to take the conscious freedom that we won, but to go back into nature and participate it in a way that we did previously, but now consciously. But what this means, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, is that we are responsible for nature, not God. In essence, we now have entered into what Owen Barfield calls a directionally creator relationship with nature. Nature now will reflect our states of mind. It's pretty scary when you think about it. So in that sense, I'm not saying that the technology is good or bad. Technology is indifferent. It's actually neutral. It's what you do with the technology and whether you let the technology own you or you own the technology. How many of us would like to go back to a day without technology? I don't think so. So as much as we criticize technology, we also are creatures and our world is a function of technology and of these machines. But that doesn't mean it can't evolve into a different direction or a different meaning. Right now, unfortunately, has a meaning which sometimes is quite negative. So, anyway, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I just want to express my view. I could be wrong. Pardon me. Maybe I misunderstood. That's also possible. In my mind, whatever I have read or the gist of that, I feel whatever is happening today, we are gaining independence, is evolution of intellect. Whereas if there is an evolution of super consciousness, we feel more connected. There is more connection. Like Rudy mentioned in the beginning about near-death experience of some individuals, I think they have reached a level of evolution of consciousness. That's why they don't see anything evil. They are finding something, some essence in everything, whether it's AIDS or cancer. That's the, I call, in my mind, I call evolution of super consciousness. Whereas we are getting away from nature or getting closer or the evolution of technology, this is happening because of the evolution of our intellect. And they are somewhat connected, but they are disharmonious also. And when you achieve the level of super consciousness, then you see the light. And that's where you don't find the difference between individuals or nations or nature, whatever we can call. That's how I see it, but I'm not saying I'm right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else want to comment or say anything? No? Anybody have any questions? Yeah. Okay.
I guess, you know, as individuals, collectively, we can come to terms with our own mind and how we perceive things, perception being reality. But I think it's the people that are out there that have a different perception on how the world is, whether it be the evil dealing with their issues in this type of manner. So what I'm struggling with is how the so-called evil that is out there, we're not dealing with them on the same terms that we are as far as mindset is concerned and what their belief systems are and their gods and you know, it's kind of like a we-they kind of a thing I guess I'm dealing with here, but we're not all on the same page. And I think, you know, I guess right now the with the anger that's there and, you know, the call for action, certainly in the States, is kind of taking over. And I think it's muddying the waters a little bit. And it will continue to do that. There's no question that the good will come from this because of, you know, the fact that we're all sitting here tonight thinking, you know what's going to come of this, you know, and just not saying, well, it's close, but it's not that close. It's here. It's an assault on our lives, our freedoms, and but we're not dealing with the same type of individual. I mean, we can collectively think to ourselves, you know, we can change the world, but I guess it's those evil powers out there that I'm thinking, you know, how far can it go, and how is it going to affect my kids?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's, oh, okay. Yeah.
So honestly, I don't in any way wish that this hadn't happened because I believe that there has to be evil in order to be good, and I think that to pain and suffering, that's how people learn. And so we can't say, we're speaking in terms of a God that he wouldn't want this, because I don't think that he doesn't want pain and suffering for us. Because I would never want there to be no pain and suffering for me or for anyone else. That's heavy line.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, I think the comment that you made, Al, is a valid one, and it's one that we all have to face. Clearly, you can approach the issue at many different levels. At the immediate level, until you have worked through another solution, you're stuck in a sense with the framework or the terms of reference of the old state of mind. If we look at Dr. Hahnemann, who founded his system of Heilkunst, his first step was to work within the existing system of medicine, because that's what he was taught. In doing that, he came to the gradual realization that he was actually doing more harm than good. And in his mind, breaching the Hippocratic Oath, you know, first do no harm. He didn't rationalize it, as many doctors do, by, well, I'm pretty sure I'm doing more good because I'm told that I am, or the authorities tell me, or the statistics tell me. He had a deep inner ethical reaction to what he was doing in his world, that he was harming his patients more than he was helping them. And he felt that so strongly that when his children became sick, he actually refused to give them medicine, the official approved medicine, the one he was taught he should give in order to save them. And that would be a horrendously difficult decision for a parent to make. But it came from his inner conviction, and of course he has to deal with that in terms of his conscience with his creator at the time, when it comes to that. But he made a decision from his knowledge that he could not continue, as convenient as it would have been, along the old rules. But he didn't have another answer yet. He didn't know what to do otherwise, but he wasn't going to give them the old solution. In a sense, this is the problem that many people now are starting to face, is that, well, the old answer is retaliation. Bring in the military, more security, tighten up controls, you know, we'll bomb some country, or we'll find the terrorist nest, and we'll strike, and we'll cut it out. We've heard all of this kind of surgical language from Vietnam. And yet, if we reject that, we're left with a kind of hopelessness of, well, what do we do? Which is the kind of hopelessness that Hahnemann was left with his children when they were sick. It's sort of, well, what do I do? But he refused to do what supposedly was being mentioned, because this was acceptable by authoritative means. This is where you have to have the courage, in a sense, to stand up into the unknown and say, I don't know what else to do, but I sure know this isn't going to work. Well, people say you have to come up with a solution. Well, then you work and you work and you work for a solution. And that solution may not be tomorrow and may not be next year. It may be 10 years. You may spend a lifetime working towards something which would provide another way of looking at things. In the meantime, you have to carry on your conscience whatever the consequences of that are in terms of any lives. If, for example, you had a position of responsibility and you made a conscious decision not to go the route of fear and retaliation, but as a result of that some lives were lost, you would have to bear that responsibility. So no one can make that decision except you. No one can say to you, you should do this or you should do that, because you're the one